This program is an encore presentation of a previously broadcast dialogue program. Today on Dialogue, we're going to continue our very personal look at America's very special contribution to the world's musical culture, jazz. And just as jazz is played to be felt and remembered for its very direct impact on us, we're going to continue to look at it through the eyes of one man and his music. And that, of course, is Dr. Robert S. Litvak. Welcome back to Dialogue, Bob.
Nice to be here.
You know, continuing on with our survey of this great musical form, I think it's appropriate, having covered the big band era in our previous conversation, to turn now to the post-war era, 1945, and the expression bebop comes immediately to mind. What's bebop? Why is it important?
Well, it's interesting. Actually, I suppose it's better to begin thinking of bebop really during the war. Mm-hmm. It is perhaps a tragic but realistic element of our country's history that many of the great black musicians were not drafted into bands, or if they were drafted, they frequently did things that required very little skill. The bottom line is there was a magnificent group of unbelievably skillful jazz artists who remained out of service. That is, civilians. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, they had an opportunity to really hold sway at a time when many of the white musicians were away.
Who are some of these people?
Well, of course, the genius of geniuses, Charlie Parker, known lovingly as the Bird,
right.
Dizzy Gillespie, the great Max Roach, the great drummer, Gillespie, of course, being the magnificent trumpet player, and so many others. Mm-hmm. But Dizzy and Charlie Parker began playing a type of jazz that was uniquely different in a sense that they were, I think it is not unreasonable to say, anxious to demonstrate a jazz form that was unique to them and signally different from the classic jazz metier.
Do I take it, and I think this is a very important point, that this bebop era and these two geniuses, I think is the only correct word, developed their musical form largely as, I'm struggling for the right expression, but I'm thinking of the two of them, I'm thinking of a very individualistic phenomena as opposed to a school, in
yes.
other words.
Uh-huh. Well, of course, there were others, and I mean not to suggest that I'm the expert in this era. People like Miles Davis and others, who themselves were simply the fathers of the persistent and existing medium called modern jazz.
Right.
But it's interesting to reflect on the fact that it had a visceral racism about it, or a response to racism. In fact, as Mel Torme points out in one of his books, the white musicians were known as au fait, which is Pig Latin for foe, F-O-E.
Right.
And it is a bitter expression on the part of the blacks of the fact that so many times they're the basic visceral jazz sense that grew out of the agonies of the blacks was in large measure, from an economic standpoint, being, if you will, taken away from them.
Yeah.
And bebop had as its at least centerpiece the demonstrably brilliant facility of these jazz artists like Dizzy and the Bird.
Before we listen to a selection by Dizzy and the Bird that you've chosen for us, it occurred to me I should really ask you this right now. What's musically different about bebop as opposed to other forms of jazz? What distinguishes it from a musician's point of view?
Right. Well, as a non-expert, rather than a simple well, that sounds like a little bit of a dance figure. But the point is, the bebop players would, from a time standpoint, really manipulate time so that while there was an underlying 4-4 rhythm to most of the early bebop, which, by the way, frequently has been extended to time signatures that are remarkable and far from 4-4, very complex figures like 9-13 and so on that these geniuses could play. But the point is that within whatever time signature there was a profusion of notes frequently slightly out of time, but ultimately coming back into time.
Mm-hmm.
If that sounds a little ambiguous, it was a deliberate demonstration to indicate that though there was an underlying time signature, time was relative and they could bring it back at a given moment when the brain decided it was time so to do.
That sounds fascinating. What have you chosen, Bob, for us to hear?
There was a, in I guess mid-1945, there was a recording of the Dizzy Gillespie All-Stars doing something called Hot House.
Hot House?
Yes.
Hot House. Let's hear Hot House. That's a brilliant piece of music, Bob.
Indeed.
Let me single out one element there, one musician, one position, the drummer. What's the drummer doing? And who is the drummer, by the way?
Sid Catlett, Big Sid, one of the real heroes of Buddy Rich. Sid, who was a great soloist, was just laying down a solid beat, integrating with listening to the other players, if you will, leading them gently, firmly, but never getting in the way.
You know, another phenomenon that we can associate, not just with the post-war era, but as you point out with bebop, starting perhaps during the war years, but then accentuating, is the vocalist. What's particularly important about the vocalist? Now, I understand from our earlier conversation, Bob, that the big band as a phenomena was doomed by economics and other factors, but what really does the vocalist bring into jazz as he and she, as men and women, come in as singers at this point?
Well, I would be less than truthful if I were not to say that most of them would do better in a supper room, and that's that. But then there were some of the great black vocalists like Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, and of course on and where some of them were in their own right talented musicians. But those who weren't, like Ella, who began with the great Chick Webb's band when she was, I think, 16. The way I've referred to these great ones who've contributed is that they are musicians who happen to sing. And everyone who made a contribution really had a time sense, a taste sense, where essentially they grooved with and integrated with the band.
So in other words, these are not people just up there fronting. These are people using that voice as an instrument with a musical sense as acute as anybody else up there playing.
Absolutely. I recall a particular concert. I've just heard a couple of tracks that Ella did when she was in Germany with her, backed by her group, and it went on for 20 minutes. Simply the audience and she, they were one. And when she tried to bring the tune to an end, you could hear the audience simply agitating more and more and more. And it was just a magnificent reflection of when the band, the vocalist, and the audience are one, it is a heavenly experience.
Before we even turn to our selection of a vocalist, just to get a sense of what we've been talking about here, Bob, let me quickly ask you that question. The audience, how important is the audience to the jazz musician?
It's everything. First of all, the finest recordings are absolutely always made with a live audience. Simply, it adds the gasoline to the band, the juice. Now, that is not to disparage all those great things done in recording studios, but when you've got a live audience urging that band on, the reaction of the soloists, in fact, the band itself, it's just a unique experience.
Wow.
And so the audience contributes substantially. And when the audience, for whatever reason, mostly because the bands themselves have not, if you will, cut it, if the band is flat, the audience quickly becomes flat, and the whole evening is a disaster.
Having spent such evenings, I know exactly what you mean, unfortunately. What vocalist have you chosen for us to listen to, Bob?
Well, you know, there's so many great ones. The reason why I picked the one I did was, I confess, because of an intimacy of two people. I have picked Mel Torme doing a little thing with Buddy Rich's band. It's a thing called Lady Be Good. And perhaps because I have such admiration for Buddy as a drummer, it reflects the one thing that very few drummers can do, as you'll hear. Mel will be scatting in this, as you'll hear, the tune, and he'll do a four-bar scat, and immediately Buddy will absolutely replicate what Mel has just done. Now, you cannot prepare for this. It requires a level of technical facility, i.e. brain and hand correlation, that requires a level of technical capacity that almost no one can do except a genius like Buddy Rich. Now, don't misunderstand, there are other drummers who, when they play a solo, it has a melodic sense reflecting that in the tune. But it's one thing to play a solo that really does reflect a melodic sense. But it's another thing when you are recording a tune where the vocalist is scatting and you simply reflect what he's just done.
Boy, you have really whetted our appetite to hear this.
It's a great thing. I think you'll enjoy it.
Lady Be Good?
Lady Be Good.
Let's hear Lady Be Good. Do 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 I got to say it again. Wow.
Wow is right.
Okay, you know, a couple of things about that piece, Bob, immediately. The tribute to Ella in there, I think that was remarkable.
Just, yeah.
Gracious and magnificent.
Great lady.
And thank you for the explanation about scat. And tell me something now. These men, as Mel Torme invents his scat phrasing, Buddy Rich is improvising also, following along, right?
Absolutely. It's not written. It's a head thing that's done that basically plays around the fundamental progression of the tune.
Mm-hmm.
And Mel is, as a musician, and by the way, he's a fine drummer and plays lovely piano. But in any event, Mel is singing just as another soloist would do a particular solo. Mel is scatting, namely playing with a particular progression in his own unique way.
Yeah.
And Buddy brilliantly is following the thing that he's just done, which is a particular arrangement of notes and time in a fashion that uniquely copies just what Mel has done.
That's the key word, I thought. Copy and respond to, don't compete with.
Right.
Got it, yeah. You know, we've talked about jazz as an American phenomenon, which it is, but it's obviously true, Bob, that it is an international phenomenon, increasingly so.
Yes.
I'd like to talk to you a bit about that. Where did this begin? And I sort of think this might take us back, at least briefly, to something we were talking about earlier, the big band era. I have that suspicion, but you tell us. I mean, where do you first get a sense that it's becoming more than an American phenomenon?
Well, certainly, the history of popular music, if you will allow me to use that term, which has some unhappy connotations. But the point is, it would be disrespectful to all of the jazz artists in even the 20s in France and England and Germany, who, having heard on record American jazz, primarily the black artists, they themselves, starting with great difficulty, like the Hot Club of France, as they called it, and even in Germany, pre-Hitler Germany. And parenthetically, it's interesting that one of the things that Hitler did was to absolutely ban the playing of American jazz.
That's exactly right.
Anyhow, the standpoint of the big band change in England, the presence of the American musicians because of the war, World War II, gave people the opportunity to really not only listen to but actually associate with these American jazz artists. And of course, one of them that comes to mind is a man who really was with a society band at the Grosvenor House in London. A man by the name of Ted Heath.
Oh, yes.
And Ted Heath, it is said, having heard particularly the Miller Band, which was based near London, and having had the opportunity to play with some of these men, Heath made a decision that was in many ways an economically brave one, because he was, again, in his 40s. The point is that he simply started from scratch with a new book, as they call it, that is a new set of arrangements,
right,
which was largely based on what he had heard it got to be a very refreshing thing to hear. If one were to listen to the Heath Band, you would hear sort of a combination of Glenn Miller, Les Brown, Count Basie, all a melange known as the Ted Heath Big Band. He had some great players in it, people like Ronnie Varell, a great drummer, great brass section led by a wonderful player named Bobby Pratt.
Right.
And I have brought along something. Now, since we've recently heard an uptune with Buddy and Mel Torme, I thought maybe you'd like to hear something that's a ballad but does reflect the richness of the Ted Heath Band.
Well, I'll tell you something, Bob. No maybe about it. Let's hear it. What's it called?
Stars Fell on Alabama.
Stars Fell on Alabama by the Ted Heath Band.
Right.
In listening to that, Bob, I heard a lot of Glenn Miller. Is that?
You did.
Uh-huh.
Glenn's impact on the big band era has simply been lasting. Mm-hmm. And frequently his impact has been played down for reasons I don't know. The music of Glenn was, yes, pretty. It was stirring at times and simply musical. And the impact of Glenn on bands both in Europe and, as much as it exists, the big band era of today, you can, if you listen carefully, mm-hmm. hear a little bit of Glenn in the big bands of the 50s and 60s, and yes, even today.
That's fascinating. Bob, to conclude a conversation that I hate concluding because I've enjoyed it so much, but let me ask you this question. It's kind of a very personal one. It's been a very personal conversation. This has struck me throughout our talking and sort of years of listening to jazz. It's a very, to use the word again, directly personal phenomenon. It's very much in the mind, in the heart, and the soul of the beholder. And in your life, one thing I'm struck by is how it's been there all along, and there was a hiatus, but then you come back to it, and I don't think you can really live without it. So I can't think of anyone better to ask this question, which might be in the minds of listeners who are not yet that familiar with it. What does it give to the listener? What does it give to the person? Why should someone want to get more familiar with jazz? What would they get?
Joy. Joy. And there are certain tunes that are, in a sense, very sensitive, sad, if you will, a reflection of the life experience. So that when I hear a particular ballad that tells a tale, it is meaningful because it begins right in the cotton fields where the blacks, those tortured souls, have to keep themselves alive. And of course, from there, it grows into hopefully a more civilized time where people speak of intimate relationships that have affected their music. And of course, the joy of swinging jazz that is simply so surpassing in its happiness that when you play it, and when you are playing with good players, and things are, if you will, swinging, there ain't nothing in this life like it except maybe one other thing.
What a great answer. Bob Litwack, thank you so much for being with us on Dialogue.
It's been a pleasure.
And for us, too.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Dr. Robert Litwack, jazz musician and cardiothoracic surgeon. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our production engineer is Anthony Barber. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. You can also listen to Dialogue on the web at wilsoncenter.org/dialogue. Email us on America Online at radiodial@aol.com. That's RADIODIAL@AOL.com.